As the squabble over who determines when a beach is clean enough continued between Exxon and the state of Alaska at the most recent FOSC meeting, Coast Guard Rear Admiral Clyde Robbins made it clear that the decision is his to make.
I think every beach has to be evaluated on its own, and the decision as to when it's when the treatment is done will be made by me, the federal on-scene coordinator. In some cases, that will mean that the Fish and Game, EPA, and a few others may not be satisfied with the decision I make, but I can't satisfy everybody in this job, so I'll do the best I can.
Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
We feel that it's going to take years and years of cleanup. In addition to Mother Nature doing her job, Exxon has done by far not enough.
State investigators have been looking into the possibility of bringing criminal charges against Exxon and Alyeska since the Exxon Valdez dumped nearly 11 million gallons of crude oil on Prince William Sound in March. But the Attorney General's top prosecutor, Larry Weeks, says all they could find in state law to charge the companies with were misdemeanors. Armed with penalties totaling just $100,000 or 90 days in jail, Weeks says the state decided to leave this area to the U.S. government.
They have much better legal tools in the sense of investigative powers and laws to deal with these things than we do. They have felonies that provide for penalties of treble damages actually incurred, and we believe that simply from a point of view of economics and rational use of resources that we deferred to federal people.
Federal law enforcement officials confirm that a criminal investigation is underway. Beyond that, they have no comment. But Weeks seems encouraged by what he knows of their efforts so far. He described them as interested and vigorous. This decision has no effect on the criminal charges still pending against Exxon Valdez skipper Joseph Hazelwood. But it will leave more money for the state to build its civil case against Exxon and Alyeska, which Attorney General Douglas Bailey has said may be filed by the end of the summer. In the wake of this aborted investigation, Weeks says he'll be suggesting some changes in state law when the legislature convenes next year. Those changes may include tougher penalties for negligent spills and a zero tolerance for alcohol use by people involved with the transportation of hazardous materials. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
Three provisions in the bill adopted by the committee came from legislation introduced by Democratic Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut. The senator introduced his legislation in response to the Exxon Valdez oil spill, but says the proposed law probably won't apply to Exxon.
I think it's going to be hard to say for certain that if this law is passed, we can force Exxon in this case to stay on the job. And the reason for that is, of course, that the spill occurred before the law went into effect. I can tell you that the members of the committee would be interested in doing whatever we can to see that the law, if it does pass, does apply to Exxon. But at least we can rest with the understanding that if this law passes, there will never again be a case where a company like Exxon can walk away from a cleanup after only one-third of the beaches in Alaska are actually cleaned up.
Lieberman's three provisions include penalties of $1,000 per barrel or $25,000 per day, whichever is greater, the imposition of triple damages against responsible parties that fail to obey an order to clean up an oil spill, and clear authority for the federal government to order a responsible party to clean up a spill. But Lieberman says that doesn't mean state rights would be preempted.
We do have an agreement, at least so far, that this law would not stop the states from passing tougher laws. In fact, there are parts of this bill that I wish were tougher. I wish that we had greater liability in some areas on the oil companies. And one of the responses of the majority leader to my concern about that today was, well, the states, if they want, states like Alaska can pass tougher laws and they'll not be blocked by the federal government. And that's good news.
Lieberman says this bill will force those at fault to be more accountable for their actions.
The bill that's coming out today is a major amendment to the Clean Water Act, and it would essentially put the Clean Water Act on the same par as Superfund. It would say that if an oil company spills oil in the water, it's going to face the same tough penalties that anybody faces when they spill hazardous waste on the land, and it builds on the basic idea that you got to have deterrence. You got to have the message get across to oil companies that if they act irresponsibly and negligently and cause an oil spill, then they're going to pay for it. And hopefully that message will lead them to act more responsibly and to do whatever they can to avoid those spills.
The Oil Pollution Liability and Compensation Act also calls for the establishment of government response teams to react to large oil spills, and a requirement that contingency plans be drawn up for worst-case scenarios. Lieberman says the Senate should vote on this bill next week. The House is considering similar legislation. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Chris Kirby in Washington, D.C.
There's concern that Exxon may only reimburse the plants for salmon losses, but plant managers say they've lost money on other fisheries as well. Because of the large number of vessels hired on cleanup, very few boats are participating in other fisheries, like black cod. In the herring fishery, not only was there less of a fishing effort, many areas had to be shut down because of the oil. So the processors feel compensation based only on the loss of salmon production is unreasonable. The processors suspect Exxon will not compensate them for all their losses because of what happened when Exxon recently handed out a $1,000 interim payment to the cannery workers. The workers at one local plant, Eagle Fisheries, were excluded from the payment because Eagle processes bottom fish. At Tuesday's oil meeting, plant managers said they assumed Exxon would compensate all the canneries that have been affected by the oil spill. Tim Blott of All Alaskan Seafood says the salmon-only stipulation came as a shock.
The situation about salmon-only never came up during the negotiations to begin with on the employees. It was all employees that had been lack of work due to the oil spill. That was it. Salmon never came up. It was never there. What worries me now is in the last 2 days, all we've been hearing is things are not negotiable anymore. And frankly, it concerns me to no end, because we have a lot of losses that are not due to just salmon. You know, we've lost bottom fish boats, we've lost black cod boats, herring, everything else. We've been kind of sitting back thinking that Exxon was going to make us whole, and frankly, right now, I'm beginning to be a little worried.
Plant managers feel excluding Eagle employees is setting a dangerous precedent, and that when the processors themselves start asking for compensation, Exxon will slap the same salmon-only provision on them. The plant managers have been trying to arrange a meeting with Exxon to discuss the matter, but they say Exxon keeps putting them off. Dave Woodruff of Alaska Fresh Seafoods.
We're hearing a lot of lip service and no action. I've been calling for the last 3 weeks trying to get claims on tenders going. Was able to get a $15,000 payment, which was a token to the $150,000 I've got hanging out already, and have already had to start paying some of these tenders because they're used to getting draws every couple weeks. So, you know, the lip service time is over. We want some action, and we want somebody down here right away.
Now that Exxon is preparing to leave the community, the processors feel time is running short. Plant managers have united to collectively pressure Exxon to deal with their concerns. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Since the Sawmill Bay hatchery was closed to commercial fishing months ago because of oil, the hatchery strategy was to harvest cost fish there while allowing seven-day-a-week commercial fishing in front of the other two hatcheries for those 15 million returning salmon. The opener began Wednesday. By Saturday noon, the Esther sub-district was closed due to reports of oil contamination. Shortly after noon on Sunday, the Cannery Creek hatchery was closed for the same reason. Little is known yet since weather curtailed any surveys by air. Boats were dispatched to collect samples and to try to determine the type of oil contamination and the source. Until the areas are safe for resumed commercial harvest, surplus hatchery fish will be taken by the Regional Aquaculture Association. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley. Exxon requested and received approval for full-scale use of a chemical fertilizer to enhance the natural breakdown of oil on Prince William Sound beaches beginning August 1st. The state approved EPA toxicity data for initial work while further testing is conducted and guidelines are developed for proper applications. The approval was pending the addition of any special restrictions in the eight areas addressed by the Interagency Shoreline Cleanup Committee today. But Exxon asked the federal on-scene coordinator to allow startup yesterday. A letter from the FOSC dated Saturday gives permission to begin on one Green Island site only, with approval of the remaining sites withheld until the ISCC determines what, if any, restrictions may apply in those areas. Exxon has purchased 500 tons of the fertilizer in a pole and seeks to use it on 70 miles of beach. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
Well, it's pretty much what we recommended to the U.S. Congress. We think that in the case of a large oil spill of the nature of the Exxon Valdez, that the Coast Guard should be vested with immediate authority and responsibility, that they ought to be allowed to tell people what to do, that the tanker fleet should be equipped with containment equipment, and that there should be an inventory of cleanup equipment and material and of trained personnel so that those people in that equipment can be on scene as quickly as possible after a spill. We are also recommending that the Coast Guard put fairly strict new standards in place in terms of tanker navigation, and that there be some systems put into place that allows for monitoring tanker traffic in and out of major harbors, of which Valdez would be one. It would operate more or less on the same principle as an air traffic control tower.
What would you say is the feeling you're getting from your fellow governors? At one point it was resentment from non-oil producing states. What are you feeling now, or what are you hearing now?
I think everybody's pretty much on the same wavelength. I think people understand that we have to produce energy in this country, and the trick is to do it right, to do it with no environmental impact if possible, and at the very least with a minimal environmental impact. People recognize that you can't operate a nation as big as ours without fossil energy, at least at the moment, and that the thing to do is to make sure that the exploration and development that takes place not only in Alaska, but offshore in the other states as well, that be done with a minimum of environmental disruption.
So you would say that the eastern, the so-called Rust Belt states are coming around as far as their relations with the oil producers?
Well, I think that any time you try to put together an energy policy, as the NGA did, I was lead governor on the energy policy that was presented to the NGA and adopted by the NGA, you have to make a trade-off. A lot of the consuming states are interested in making sure that the environment is clean, as is the case in the rest of the country. But I think it's probably accurate to say that those of us who are from producing states have to do a little educating of the people who are from states that don't produce oil and gas. And once that process has been gone through, we're able to hammer out a policy, which the Congress, by the way, has been unable to do over a long period of time. So the Congress in particular welcomes the governor's initiatives in this regard.
Governor, I understand you were on a national call-in this morning on C-SPAN. What kinds of questions did you get from people around the country, and do you have a sense of how people in the lower 48, what their concerns are with regard to Alaska?
Well, the first couple of callers wanted to know where their Social Security checks were, and I wasn't able to help them, but there were a lot of questions about the oil spill, as you might imagine, and they are pretty much the same questions that everybody has asked all along. How could this have been prevented? What do we need to do from here on out? There were several people who wanted to know about the tourism season, and I was happy to report that it appeared, at least, that we were going to have another in a long string of successful tourism seasons. And it was an opportunity to promote Alaska, and that's what I did.
Saturday, a group of processors and cannery employees negotiated with Exxon for the second round of payments to the workers. Most plant employees got a $1,000 check from Exxon in June. For the next payment, Exxon proposed the processors figure out exactly how many hours each individual has lost this summer, and the employees would be compensated accordingly. The processor said that system would be acceptable, but it would take several weeks to gather information and put the program in place. They said the workers can't wait that long. The processors insisted Exxon provide some relief to the workers within a week. The Exxon claims representative eventually agreed to cut checks immediately for the workers to the tune of $2,000. Even more importantly to the processors, Exxon agreed to drop its policy of paying only salmon workers. Now employees at the bottom fish plants are also eligible for the money. The processors pushed hard on that point because with all the boats working cleanup, production has dropped in every one of the fisheries. And when it comes time for the plants to file claims, they expect to get reimbursed for all their losses, not just the loss of salmon production. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Biodegradation is a natural process that happens all the time. Aerobic bacteria, or microorganisms that exist in the presence of oxygen, feed on oil, breaking down the molecules in order to use the carbon. In other words, the bacteria use the oil the same way we use sugar. The bioremediation project is the addition of nitrogen and phosphorus to aid bacterial growth and increase the speed of the carbon breakdown. Basically, it's adding fertilizer. EPA has been testing two different types, but it's most satisfied with an oleophilic called Inapol EAP22. The oleophilic fertilizer is a liquid that sticks to the oil and is partly soluble in the oil. In cold conditions, it has a consistency of honey, or when warmed up, it's more like shellac or varnish. Exxon has ordered 500 tons of the Inapol product and has determined 70 miles of beach will be suitable for bioremediation treatment with the liquid. However, Exxon officials were not ready to talk further about the project when contacted. The Environmental Protection Agency actually designed the bioremediation project. An aquatic biologist, Jim Clark, who works as the ecological monitoring team leader for the project, says he's confident that the toxicity test results show that Inapol will cause no harm and that guidelines for application will be based on the most sensitive species. Clark also expects that very little of the chemical fertilizer will get into the water column. He says the oleolic acid in it makes the fertilizer partially dissolve on the surface of the oil, so once sprayed, it should stay on the oil. But because it is somewhat toxic, Clark says you have to start with the worst case that risk could pose.
If all of it was washed into the water and it was contained right in the immediate nearshore zone, that we would start out with concentrations at about in this 100 part per million range. And so there's definitely a potential for toxicity under this absolute worst-case situation.
But even in the worst case, Clark says other factors should be included.
There would be dilution with the water within the bay beyond the nearshore zone, and there's dilution with depth as it goes off and gets mixed into the water in the sound. And then there's tidal mixing that moves the water in and out. And there's sufficient mixing with all of these factors combined that if the worst case happened, that it all washed off, there's still sufficient mixing to reduce the concentrations to below these toxic levels that we saw in laboratory tests.
That's the worst case. But EPA's Clark says what's actually expected to happen is for the fertilizer to stay on the beach with only 1 or 2% washed into the water through accidental overspray or application. And at that, toxic levels would never be reached. The state has accepted EPA test results thus far and has approved full-scale use of Inapol for high-energy open water areas. But the state has also limited the use to 5 sites on Green Island and 3 sites on Seal Island while awaiting final test results and guidelines to assure proper application, according to DEC Research and Development Team Leader Alex Viteri. Viteri says he feels very comfortable with bioremediation. With the good science package presented and the manner in which it's headed, as long as it's applied correctly. But he warns that bioremediation is not a fix-all. It's just a speed-up of a natural process.
By doing that, we've changed what might take, just to use numbers, 8 to 10 years to decompose oil to maybe 3 to 4 years. Maybe it's 5, we don't know yet. So we haven't, it's not a quick fix. On the other hand, we might be surprised to find out it cleaned it up in 2 years. That'd be great.
But Terry notes that still unanswered questions will require continuous monitoring, and the end result is still not clean.
The long ends of the hydrocarbon there, the grease and the wax and stuff, will still be on the shore. The rocks will still be black. So it's not going to end up with a completely clean beach, and I don't want to give anyone the illusion that we would end up with that. What we would end up with is the least impact on the beach in terms of getting the toxins off and as much of the oil off as we can.
But Terry says these are hard decisions for the state to make, but the crude on the beach is far more toxic than the cure. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
Well, it's pretty much what we recommended to the U.S. Congress. We think that in the case of a large oil spill of the nature of the Exxon Valdez, that the Coast Guard should be vested with immediate authority and responsibility, that they ought to be allowed to tell people what to do.
DEC's regional program manager, Bob Flint, says there were few who favored incineration. Some who didn't like any aspect, incineration, transfer, or storage. A great deal of concern given over the level of protection offered to the public. And a fair amount of comment that said it's okay to dispose or treat it someplace else, but not here. But Flint says that kind of attitude can backfire.
Because somewhere, sometime, places like Arlington, Oregon, are going to say no to waste from Alaska. And we'll have to begin to deal with it. So it's something that if we generate the waste, and we did generate this waste, somewhere we're going to need to begin to handle our own here.
We'll learn if that time has come in the next few days when DEC's decision is due. Exxon, meanwhile, is moving the incinerator barges into place, anticipating approval and getting ready for immediate startup when it's given. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
The 30-day public comment period for the incineration closed Monday. Bill McLaren says technically the DEC can grant the permits as soon as the public comment period's over, but first the public submissions will be evaluated. He says the draft permit has been formulated based on the concerns expressed over the applications for the four different incinerators.
Everybody seems primarily concerned that if they are allowed to operate, that the testing be very stringent, you know, and we make sure that they can meet any kind of standard that could possibly be applied.
Bill McLaren says a short-term permit, about 30 days, will allow enough burning to be accomplished for significant testing. The incinerators will then close down until the emission test results can be evaluated. In Wrangell, I'm Rhonda Litchwark.
There is serious question at this point as to whether the Attorney General can continue to represent the Council in light of its previous opinions in favor of the oil company's positions.
In this plan, Alyeska is careful not to promise it can contain and handle an oil spill the size of the Exxon Valdez. But Nick Mitchell, the oil spill expert who helped draft the document, says they now have the organization and equipment to tackle 10 million gallons of oil gushing from a tanker.
Nobody's ever done it before. What we've done is put in place equipment where we're going to jolly well try to do it. And you can only do that when the next one occurs. We'll tell you whether we were successful or not.
There are huge differences between this plan and the one in place when the Exxon Valdez ran aground. That early plan had booms and cleanup skimmers for much smaller spills parked in Valdez. Now under state order, Alyeska is required to prepare for a 10 million gallon spill. Alyeska looked briefly at a spill that size before the March 24th disaster, and despite state objections, called that document a scenario, not a plan of action. But this new document spells out how Alyeska will respond in any tanker accident, and the company says it's ready to be held to this one. The state is requiring Alyeska to have boats with oil containment boom shadow tankers transiting the sound. Alyeska says it's taken that idea one step further and is using larger oil field service boats to carry booms and skimmers. An additional vessel with cleanup gear will be permanently stationed in Prince William Sound. And if an oil spill occurs, Nick Mitchell says the strategy is to lay out enough boom from the nearby escort vessels to contain the oil and keep it from spreading.
You'll contain the oil, you'll concentrate it, and you'll recover it. And the plan will tell you that the whole intention in this is that we must contain to start with, to stop that spreading triangle. And in containment, you thicken up the layer of oil. So consequently, the skimming device you put on it meets only oil, so it recovers at its high rated capacity.
While skimmers on the Exxon Valdez spill fail to work anywhere near their rated capacity, Mitchell says future spills will be different because of the large concentrations that will be fed into the skimming equipment. As with previous plans, Alyeska says dispersants and burning may be used, and it says in some situations, dispersants may be the first line of attack. This new inch-thick notebook reflects many of the lessons from the Exxon Valdez disaster. A command structure similar to that used by affected communities dealing with Exxon oil is used in this plan, and unlike earlier spill documents, there are provisions for working with the affected communities, protecting hatcheries and cleaning up beaches. Alyeska has also taken ideas from the operations of the North Sea oil port of Solomvo. Their citizens have a say in managing operations, and a citizens advisory committee will be set up by Alyeska here to keep an eye on oil spill preparedness. A preliminary group, including several mayors and leaders from spill-affected communities, will soon be reviewing this Alyeska response plan, and they'll be creating the bylaws for this new citizens advisory committee. While Alyeska has been criticized for pulling back on its commitment to oil spill response teams in the years before the Exxon Valdez, Nick Mitchell says that's not likely to happen now.
Through particularly this Citizens Advisory Committee, you've got your built-in policing that way, which will encourage and ensure that we're kept on our toes. And I think industry momentum is going to keep going to the extent that obviously complacency will be very difficult for it to set in.
The plan now goes to the state for review. It's already gotten the blessings of Alyeska's seven owner companies. They've agreed to pay the $125,000 a day to keep the Oil Spill Response Organization on the water and in the offices. In Anchorage, I'm Bruce Melzer.
2 weeks ago, the State Department of Environmental Conservation held public hearings in five communities to answer questions and receive testimony about the incinerator barges that Exxon proposes to fire up to dispose of the massive tons of oily debris that has resulted from the spill. Bob Flint served as the hearing officer for those meetings, but his everyday job is as regional program manager of DEC's South Central Regional Office. Flint says the hearings produced a lot of questions that asked, "What are you going to do to protect us?" Flint says few but the applicants spoke in favor of incineration, while everyone else was guarded. But that really doesn't have any effect on the decision to allow the permits, although it might have some impact on the permit restrictions.
The public hearing is really not the majority wants it and the minority doesn't want it, or the other way around. We have to do, our public hearings are based on the factual information we have available to show whether or not any waste disposal proposed has a reasonable assurance of meeting those standards, and which can happen, assuming there's no local controls that would prevent. Like a lot of times, your local ordinances will prevent a certain type of waste disposal in an area. So assuming there's no local ones, what an applicant has to demonstrate is that there's reasonable assurance that they will meet the state air standards in this situation, or state water standards. And if they can do that, usually a permit is issued. Now, it may be a very restrictive permit, and sometimes we found applicants that received permits that felt that they didn't want to operate under the permit because it was too restrictive.
What I hear in there is that the public hearing was only to see how many restrictions you'd have. Or what kind?
Well, it's also, we have at public hearings brought up other facts and stuff in there, but that have eliminated it, but more so, yeah.
Exxon, anticipating approval, is moving the barges into place, according to Exxon spokesman Jillian Welch.
The Sealy barge has been deployed in Herring Bay, and the AET barge, the rotary kiln barge, is being got ready to go to Kodiak. Now, neither of those have been approved at this time, but in order to expedite the use of those barges as soon as the approvals do come through, which we expect to be this week, we wanted to get those barges underway as quickly as possible.
DEC says Exxon can move the incinerator barges wherever it wants. They just can't be fired up without approval. DEC's decision on the permit is expected in the next day or two. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
Hi, I'm Dennis Vance. I'm a member of this group. I'm a cannery worker like the rest of us. We are non-union. We're just trying to get claims paid that Exxon promised to pay. Jay Brown told us they would pay. We filed our claims. We told them what we were going to do, and they said, come back in 9 days for your check, and here we are, and they say, no check. We're asking for the claims on file right now to be paid, and in writing, our next claim to be paid within 14 days, because that's the claim we file at the end of the year, and we're not going to be here. If we don't get it in writing, these people are going to tell us no, like they're telling us now. You know, they didn't expect us to come out in force. They didn't expect us to get news attention. NBC was here this morning. UPI was here. They all know we have a good flight. Exxon said they will pay all legitimate claims, and this is not an illegitimate claim. We're asking for 23 hours lost because Fish and Game closed it because of oil, and Exxon's telling us it's not their fault. Who else spilled oil out there? There's only one company. We're not asking anything astronomical. We're asking what we were promised. There's people here from Florida, California, Mexico, Maine, all over the United States. I'm from Idaho. All I want is what was promised to me. You know, we're here willing to work. They took our work. They should pay us for it. And they did. They paid us during the herring season, but now they're refusing to pay us during the salmon season. I mean, you know, if they refuse to pay us, who's next?
How long do you expect to stay?
Until we get our checks.
Have you had any response from inside the building?
Only that our companies have class action suits. Talk to your own company. We were promised any money, any time lost due to oil, Exxon would be happy to reimburse us. So we didn't worry about it when we came up. And now we're finding the time that we're sitting around, like today, we could have been working. But the areas are closed due to oil. That's not our fault. It's only one person to fault here, and that's Exxon.
Thank you.
Besides their demands in writing, the demonstrating cannery workers came to the Exxon Control Center with rules of conduct, not to block doorways or interfere with traffic, and to cooperate with all requests except the request to leave. That's totally opposite to the way Earth First operates, which held a protest here a week ago. A press release says local police arrested one individual for chaining herself to the Exxon building front door and chased two others from the roof of the building when they attempted to erect a banner. In reaction, Coast Guard Public Information Officer Jack O'Dell says information about the Earth First group was requested from the FBI.
There is reason to believe that the group has been responsible for damaging property and activities which may have resulted in the injuries to other individuals. Initial inquiries from the FBI show that members of the group have been arrested in the past for criminal trespass and destruction of property. Presently, there is no record showing the group taking credit for any criminal activity.
Besides checking up on Earth First's record, the Coast Guard went on threatcom alert.
That's a military term that means there's a possibility that exists some chance for some overt activity.
Their press release says as of July 19th, the Coast Guard is taking necessary procedures to assure safety. Coast Guard units have been advised and necessary precautions have been implemented.
Basically just security precautions, very low profile, just make sure that our area is secure from any possible trespass or any possible danger. We're not looking to accost anyone. It's just strictly to make sure that we have integrity within the Coast Guard facilities.
Coast Guard spokesman Jack O'Dell. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
We are rescuing far fewer birds and otters than we had in earlier months, and so a cutback of some scale is pretty much in order. We agree with that. The letter we got this weekend was a little bit of a surprise to us, however, because it involved much more of a cutback than we had anticipated, and we hadn't really talked too much about that. We are still recovering a lot of dead birds. About 800 birds were recovered last week. We're interested, of course, not in just the live birds that we can save, but seeing where we're continuing to get mortality of birds and otters. We're hoping that we'll still be able to continue with that program with the number of boats that are cut back, but again, at this point, we're looking to reorganize our resources and make sure that we can still do the job that we think needs to be done. We'll continue to work with the resources that we have, but we understand from the Exxon folks that their reduction is non-negotiable. We had been talking with them in terms of a gradual phase down. This is just a little bit more abrupt than we had anticipated.
Testimony last Friday by Exxon President Bill Stevens and the release of a memo from Exxon's on-scene official Otto Harrison have fueled congressional anger over the company's commitment to clean up Alaska shores in the wake of the Exxon Valdez spill. California Representative George Miller has called a special meeting of the House Interior Subcommittee on Water and Power this Friday to discuss the issue. Committee aide Jeff Petrick says when Miller visited Valdez in May, he pointed out that the perpetrator of the crime should not be allowed to define the restitution. The Exxon memo says in part that the company's only obligation is to keep state and federal agencies informed of its plans, not to seek approval. Petrick says that has caused a great deal of alarm throughout Congress. The aide says Congressman Miller believes it's the Coast Guard, working with the state of Alaska and others, who is responsible for overseeing the restoration of Alaska's resources, not, in his words, the sovereign state of Exxon. On the invitation list for Friday's hearing are Exxon's Bill Stevens, Coast Guard Admiral Paul Yost, and Alaska DEC Commissioner Dennis Kelso. Governor Cooper's press aide David Ramser says media interest in the spill has been at least temporarily reignited by the memo. His list of interested news organizations includes the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Chicago Tribune, all three major television networks, both evening and morning programs, plus ABC's Nightline, Cable News Network, and others. Ramser says Kelso was also scheduled to appear on the McNeil Air NewsHour, but that was canceled after Exxon reportedly refused to appear on the program. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
Last week before a Congressional Ocean Policy Studies subcommittee, Exxon Company President William Stevens confirmed the September 15th termination date for cleanup of the oil. Coast Guard Vice Admiral Clyde Robbins is the federal on-scene coordinator for cleanup of the spill. Robbins says Exxon does intend to withdraw its cleanup forces this fall because of safety concerns, but on Monday he said the exact date for demobilization is still undetermined.
They indicated that they were studying the weather patterns and that sort of thing and looking at how long it would take them to demobilize, what the implications were of that, because they don't want to have forces out in bad weather and perhaps lose some lives. So their demobilization date will be set on safety, and it's going to be pretty much up to them.
After demobilization, Robbins says Exxon and various agencies plan to monitor the oil throughout the winter.
As the way I visualize it is, Exxon, DEC, and the Coast Guard, probably others, will continue surveillance to some extent throughout the winter, so that we know what's happening. There's no work planned for the winter unless we see a mass migration of oil or something that's headed toward sensitive areas or something like that, and then there would be an effort to corral that. I don't really anticipate that happening, but we have to be prepared for it. Then in the spring, there will be an evaluation made of the condition of the shoreline throughout the area, and then a decision made as if work needs to be done, what kind and how much.
Robbins believes Exxon will return next spring if they are convinced the work should continue. In Kodiak, I'm Matt Miller.
Cordova has been victim to a wide range of problems related to the Exxon Valdez oil spill, and all of those problems are routed through the Cordova Oil Spill Response Office. Paralegal Brenda Guest works as deputy director at the response office.
Those problems can range from I'm not getting enough hours at the cannery, my boat's not being rotated, my contract's not being honored by Exxon, my checks from Exxon aren't being signed correctly, there's no housing in town, there's no labor in town, Exxon's paying too much money and they're robbing the labor force, we have to have housing so we can bring in new labor. How are we going to bring in new labor? We have child care problems. The child caregivers have been taken out on the oil spill. We have no people to take care of our children. We have more children to be taken care of because everybody's out working on the oil spill in one sense or another. This entire city, as you probably know, was brought out and put in force, and everybody's been working really hard. So child care has been an issue. And we're trying to get funding because Exxon doesn't want to pay for professional staff to assess. This is the term they reject, to assess the damage to the community.
What sort of
What sort of response do you get? You've got an Exxon community liaison here in the town. Do you get response, or?
In early May, they were much more responsive than they are in July. We could make phone calls and go down there and get our answers questions, have them walk around town, have them look at our problems. It's the end of July. They're pulling out. They basically have their feet up on their desks and their hands behind their heads and saying, yeah, what is it you want?
Brenda Guest, Deputy Director of the Cordova Oil Spill Response Office. I'm Sue Rapley.
According to Exxon's claims guidelines, each drift fisherman will be paid based on his anticipated share of the catch this year, which is calculated from how well he did during the 1986 and 88 seasons. Theo Matthews, who's the president of the United Cook Inlet Drift Association, says this second payment from Exxon will amount to about $11,000 for the average drift fisherman. That's after a crew share is deducted, as well as the advance already received, and a flat 5% for expenses. Matthews has been talking with Exxon and trying to convince them to adjust some of the formulas they're using to calculate claims. But he hasn't been too successful. Exxon will base the payment to fishermen on a price of $1.40 a pound for sockeyes. Matthews says a more accurate figure would be $1.70 a pound. He says the difference amounts to about $5,000 for the average drift fisherman. A bigger issue, though, is the compensation plan is based on the Department of Fish and Game's pre-season harvest forecast. The forecast for the sockeye catch in the inlet was 2.5 million, but the run, which is now being hauled in only by set netters, is coming in stronger, and the harvest should end up at least a million more than forecast. Matthew says if Exxon paid fishermen based on the actual harvest, the average drifter would get about $11,000 more. He says his organization intends to have some serious discussions with Exxon about the issue.
Obviously, we've told them if they don't pay the actual run size now, they're going to have to pay it in court anyway. There's no way in our mind they will ever not have to pay for these fish if you can document they came. They're telling us right now that, yes, that may be the case for Cook Inlet, but look at Prince William Sound. We guaranteed 40 million pinks, and it doesn't look like you're going to get 40 million pinks. Our position is, that's your problem. In Cook Inlet, we're going to have 3.5 to 4 million red salmon, and you should pay for that now.
Exxon claims manager Tom Critchlow said Exxon would not consider an adjustment to take into account there's a bigger sockeye run. He said they were going to stick with the claims guidelines that were announced in June. Theo Matthews isn't satisfied, but acknowledged that Exxon is at least paying fishermen something. He said the company has no legal obligation at this point, and the fishermen are getting the money now without having to go to court. But Matthews says the compensation plan falls way short of what it should be.
I can't imagine one drift fisherman that would be satisfied with this. I know I won't be. There's nothing in here that speaks of your lost opportunity, the 3 months of stress we've all gone through. Frankly, the oil companies cannot come in here and Oil Cook Inlet and say, I'll simply pay you dollar for dollar what you would have made. First of all, they can't really demonstrate that clearly to any of us. And second of all, we want to fish. You know, we don't want to be in courts every year of our lives.
United Cook Inlet Drift Association President Theo Matthews. Reporting from Homer, I'm Eileen Hughes.
Well, we'd be studying the effects on the population, how long those effects persist, whether somehow or other the observed effects of the oil now carry over for another year.
When we put up a fuss, we sometimes find that it exerts some pressure on Exxon to change their minds, but we can't tell them to do anything. They don't have to pay any attention to the state, and often they don't.
Cooper says federal law prevents both the state and federal governments from taking over the oil spill cleanup. If either government does take over, then it assumes the liability for the cleanup. Cooper said he read the memo from Exxon to the man that President Bush has put in charge of the cleanup, the chief administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, Bill Riley.
There may well be some pretty high-level discussions with Exxon over this decision. So it may be that they'll find it expedient to change their minds.
I'm Jeff Kennedy.
Kelso spent most of his time talking about the now infamous Exxon memo. Subcommittee members characterized the memo as stupid, but Kelso said he fears Exxon is serious.
Basically, I think that the Exxon strategy is to close down its shoreline operations September 15th and go home. Now, they've said they're going to do certain other things over the winter, but those are really not the kind of field operations that we think would be most productive.
Kelso says cleanup efforts need to continue into the spring and says Exxon's lack of action this winter will lead to even greater problems next year.
In the spring, we need to have had Exxon actively preparing to get back into the field. During the winter months, equipment can be reconditioned, new materials can be procured, and the planning for doing the work that remains can be undertaken so that when spring arrives, we can get out in the field actively and getting the job done right.
Kelso says Exxon still has plenty of work to do in Alaska, and the cleanup will not be finished by September 15th. He says he is investigating Exxon's legal obligations. Right now, Exxon's cleanup efforts are voluntary. Kelso told subcommittee members that memo appears to violate all previous agreements.
I will say that the tone of the memo took me aback somewhat, because the tone of the memo appears to reject the state and the Coast Guard's decisions about what needs to be done. It uses words like non-negotiable and that these decisions are not open for discussion. Well, it looks to me as if that suggests that Exxon believes, or at least some of the top-level managers believe, that this system ought to work backwards.
Kelso says Exxon cannot unilaterally decide to pull out. He says Exxon has made promises to Alaska, and the memo represents a breach of faith.
The guarantee is very clear that Exxon will stay until the job is done right, and that they intend to do that, and they're committed to do that. We expect them to live up to that. Maybe we're a little too old-fashioned in Alaska, but the two principles that we think still operate here are: if you make a promise, you ought to keep it, and if you make a mess, you ought to clean it up. And if Exxon can't live by those, then it seems to me we ought to take a look at the rules under which they operate.
The House Interior Committee will hold a hearing later this week examining such difficult questions as how clean is clean and who decides when Exxon's work is over. Officials from Exxon, the Coast Guard, and the state of Alaska are expected to testify. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Chris Kirby in Washington, D.C.
The state laws on what the state can do to compel Exxon to either keep cleaning up after September 15th or pay for someone else to clean up after the Exxon Valdez is both direct and vague. The law says quite simply that whoever spills shall clean it up immediately. But the law doesn't say what exactly cleanup means, and the state will probably have to convince a judge that Exxon hasn't done the job if it wants to change the oil company's mind. Assistant Attorney General Douglas Mertz.
Either the state or the federal government could go into court and show that there was an inadequate cleanup and attempt to convince the court that the spiller should go back and do more. On the other hand, both governments have the option of cleaning it up themselves and, in effect, billing the company for the cost.
While Exxon weathers a fresh storm of negative publicity over its decision to pull out, no decision has been made on how the state will follow up its argument that Exxon should maintain some presence in the spill area. Most of the state officials who will be making those decisions are out of state, some dealing with renewed congressional interest in the spill. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
At Tuesday's oil spill meeting, Department of Fish and Game Regional Supervisor Larry Nicholson said the department's test fishing vessels continue to find oil moose in most areas around the island. Dennis Pritchard of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said over 16,000 dead birds have been picked up in the Kodiak and Katmai areas, and the numbers seem to be increasing, though at a slower rate than in the first days of the spill. At the same time, Exxon has cut back the number of animal catcher vessels from 11 to 8. Also, Arnie Shryock of the Department of Environmental Conservation gave a report on the activities of beach cleanup crews. Shryock said on several occasions, DEC observers found teams not working in the afternoon. Often when crews were on the beach, they were found standing around. And in other cases, teams were found working in the wrong area. Under the circumstances, many in the audience found it hard to believe enough of a cleanup can be accomplished by mid-September. Fisherman Terry Stone.
I don't know whose job is it to keep a fire under Exxon as far as it seems to me they're already backing out. They're demobilizing, cutting back on boats. They make these decisions on their own. Can't they be reversed? If anything, they should increase the efforts in the remaining 7 weeks. I don't see how they can just make these decisions and then they stick. Demobilization is not what should be happening now, if anything.
But according to the Coast Guard, Exxon is not starting to demobilize. Coast Guard Commander Smith says Exxon is actually increasing the cleanup effort in the next 7 weeks.
We're not scaling back. I don't see a scale back of the cleanup effort at this point. They're bringing additional teams. They're bringing additional vessels on to speed up the rate at which they're cleaning up. But you've got to recognize that with an effort of the magnitude of this and the number of vessels that they have out there and the number of people, not only here in Kodiak, but in the entire operation up in the Sound and Homer and Seward and the other locations, you have to plan an orderly and organized process for that. You can't work right up to the last minute and all of a sudden expect it to be folded up and taken care of right away. You have to have contingencies. We're talking hundreds of boats and thousands of people, and you have to start the planning process for that early on.
Whether Exxon is demobilizing or planning to demobilize, the announcement that cleanup would discontinue took locals by surprise because all through the summer, the Coast Guard here has said Exxon can't leave until the Coast Guard says it can leave. And now it appears the company doesn't have to consult with anyone to discontinue the cleanup. Kodiak resident Tricia Gartland wanted to know who's going to be responsible if Exxon pulls out and doesn't come back.
I don't think it's a fantasy out there that there's birds or oil or whatever. And personally, what I would like to see if Jim Sellers could get Governor Cooper on the phone so we can talk to him and see what's going on and who's going to accept the responsibility here. Is it the state? Is it us? If it's us, fine. But, it's coming at us way too fast and too soon. Could that happen? That we could get a teleconference with Governor Cooper at one of these meetings where we can find out from him what's going on?
The governor's representative in Kodiak, Jim Sellers, said he would find out if Cooper is available for a teleconference. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Some 30 people demonstrated Wednesday in front of the Exxon building in Anchorage. Their protests were aimed at Exxon's handling of the cleanup after the oil spill. Exxon is planning to stop the cleanup in September, saying the company has done the best it could. Kel Williams, one of the demonstrators, disagrees.
And that certainly is not the thing to do at this point. We feel that it's going to take years and years of cleanup. In addition to Mother Nature doing her job, Exxon has done by far not enough.
Casey Cole from New Jersey made the headlines some time ago when he asked Exxon President L.G. Roll to resign at the shareholders' meeting. At the protest, Cole carried a sign that said, "Roll, the Exxon slime ball." He says Exxon's attitude after the oil spill is reason to believe the company isn't to be trusted anymore.
The arrogant aristocrats that they are, you know, and the way they stand there condescending to the people. You know, we've reached a limit of our patience, and it's time for the people to take action together and show unity. You know, we've got to do the job ourselves is really what it comes down to.
Wednesday's demonstration was part of a number of protests throughout the East Coast, ranging from Anchorage to Tijuana. In Anchorage, I'm Michael Vanderzoo.
The set-aside beaches are typical of many situations here. Exxon proposed to set aside numerous beaches for environmental studies and submit a list to the Interagency Shoreline Cleanup Committee. The ISCC recognized the need for study, but wanted a limited number of sites, detailed information about the projects, and a promise of eventual cleanup.
It took Exxon over a month to provide the information required, and even then it was changed daily. Bob Benda, DEC representative to the ISCC, said at one meeting Exxon changed the length of study period from 1 year to 5, and at the next meeting on what was supposed to be the final draft, Benda says the Exxon representative refused to commit to eventual cleanup that had been included in the submitted plan.
And he looked at that and basically said, well, we can't do that, and he crossed it out in front of us. And literally, I think there was kind of a unified, gasp going, what is going on here?
Bob Mastracchio, Exxon's technical manager, says it was internal miscommunication that resulted in the unfortunate circumstance of amending the proposal at the table. But Mastracchio insists that Exxon's position on cleanup of the sites is clear.
We cannot commit to future cleanup of a site not knowing what that means at this time.
State law says all spilled oil will be treated immediately, but state agencies were willing to compromise on 7 of the requested sites. The state attorney general's office agreed to the set-asides on the condition that Exxon submit to DEC a scientific permit, which would allow for the discharge of oil for a long period of time, since it's expected that the untreated beaches will bleed oil. However, the permit is based on the assumption that the area will eventually be cleaned, and that's the hang-up. John Robinson of NOAA, the scientific support coordinator, says NOAA will assume responsibility for the beaches now that Exxon has withdrawn, but NOAA, too, has problems with the state requirement for cleanup.
I think that the amount of oil bleeding from these sites, if any, into the future would be minimal. And again, the requirement, the state's requirement that those sites be cleaned up in some near-term future is just doesn't make too much sense.
The federal on-scene coordinator, Rear Admiral Clyde Robbins, says he thinks it would be a shame to lose this opportunity.
We need to know better what kind of procedures to use when we clean a beach area, what the eventual impact is, what it is if we leave it alone. And I just think that we would be derelict in our duties if we didn't do something so that the next 15 years shows more progress than the last 15 years.
Robin says he finds it strange to be in the position of asking for studies that Exxon has offered to fund just to find that the state requires permits. He says talks will continue to either get the projects moving or to kill them entirely. Robin says the amount of beach area under consideration for set-asides is only about a half a mile. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
The workers, all from the Icicle Seafoods plant on the Homer Spit, stood on the curb in front of the Exxon claims office, waving at passing cars and holding up signs saying Exxon owes us and Exxon lies. The workers, many of them college students wearing blue hats with the Icicle Seafood logo on it, didn't show up for work at the plant. They organized the one-day strike and the protest because they said they're tired of being told that they're going to get some money for all the hours they've missed out on. They said fewer salmon are being processed because of the closure of the drift fishery in the inlet, and they're not being compensated. Kathy Hetz is from San Francisco and has been in Homer since May.
This sign says liars. It's a fact. We've been repeatedly lied to by Icicle Seafoods, particularly the Seward Fisheries plant here in Homer, Alaska. They've been promising us a check, and we haven't seen a dime. And they keep saying it's coming, and it's coming, and it hasn't come. And they want to put it all on Exxon, and you go into Exxon, and they want to put it all on Icicle. And us as workers, we have no means to determine who is lying to us and who is responsible for paying us and when they will do it. We've been here now, I personally have been here since the middle of May, expecting to work steadily through the salmon season, and it just hasn't been happening. And I don't think anybody came up here to take a job at $6 an hour for 20 hours a week, which is all we've been working. Most people were told by the personnel manager at Icicle Seafoods that we would be working well over 40 hours a week, because in this business of fish processing, the only money to be made is really in the overtime hours.
Tony Deaton is a college student from Virginia. He's been in Homer for a couple of months, working fewer hours than he'd like to at the cannery.
We feel like we're getting a raw deal from Exxon. And, we all came to Homer because we thought the oil wouldn't come here and that we would be able to get work. Our point is we're losing hours, and we want to be paid for them by somebody.
The Exxon representative at the Homer Claims Office, Mike Haluza, says Exxon will pay the icicle employees for what they lost in hours. But he says they can't do it until Exxon gets documentation from icicle. Right now, he says they need the numbers, and then the workers will get paid. The plant manager at icicle did not respond to several requests for an interview for this story. Meanwhile, many of the cannery workers say they want to leave town soon and go back to the lower 48, but they'll be stuck in Homer because they can't afford the plane tickets home. For APRN, I'm Eileen Hughes.
I just hope that the hysteria from the oil spill isn't continued. There will be some attempts in the state legislative body this coming year to further discourage any type of investment in any of the marginable fields in the future. And I hope the Alaskan contingency gets very, very aware of this so they can tell their state senators and their state legislative body enough is enough. We need these dollars.
When Exxon said that they weren't negotiable as far as next spring, and they've retracted that statement after contact.